Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory.
Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind the headlines. I'm Brian Ballow. If you're new to the podcast, my colleagues, Ed Ayers, Joanne Freeman, Nathan Connolly, and myself are all historians, and each week we explore the history of a topic that's been in the news. And as for this week, there's been one topic in particular that has dominated the headlines: Iran.
Breaking news tonight, the shockwaves from the U.S. strike in Iraq that killed Iran's top commander. President Trump accusing Iran of planning imminent attacks on American diplomats and service members.
In Iran's parliament, chants of death to America. Tehran vowing swift revenge on American soil and announcing they will no longer abide by the uranium enrichment limits in the 2015 nuclear deal, a move which could put Iran on course to accumulate enough fuel for an atomic bomb.
By now, you probably know the timeline of what happened during this rocky and tense week. Last weekend, an American airstrike killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani at the direction of President Trump. Iran vowed to retaliate and launched more than a dozen missiles at two military bases in Iraq housing American troops. In response to the attack, President Trump addressed the nation on Wednesday and said the U.S. will impose new economic sanctions on Iran.
The fact that we have this great military and equipment, however, does not mean we have to use it. We do not want to use it. American strength, both military and economic, is the best deterrent.
So what comes next? Is this the end of the skirmish, or is it only the beginning?
A lot of people were worried that the United States would respond very harshly to any kind of counterattack by Iran. But Iran, by really striking these bases in a fashion that left no casualties, I think provided Trump with the off-ramp to call it a draw.
Hossein Banai is a professor at Indiana University's Hamilton Lugar School of Global and International Studies. He's also an author of Becoming Enemies, U.S.-Iran Relations and the Iran-Iraq War, 1979 through 1988. And just a note, we recorded this episode on Wednesday and Thursday, but this continues to be a developing story. Hossein Banai says this wasn't the first time the United States considered targeting General Soleimani.
The previous two administrations, the Obama administration and the George W. Bush administration, had each had their chance at taking him out, and they decided that the political consequences of that would not be worth it. It would expose American troops to greater risk in the region, and the fallout would really not play well for American interests in the region as a whole. But Trump, in characteristic fashion, picked the most extreme option available. The military presented President Trump with a set of options and put Soleimani as a target, as one of the options, at the really the back of the list, not thinking that he would pick it. We don't know whether there was any pushback by his national security team or the generals from the Pentagon explaining to him what the fallout could possibly be. It doesn't help that a day before that, the Iran Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei tweeted a very harsh tweet directed at Trump, saying that he was hated throughout the region and that he couldn't do anything against the glorious Islamic Republic. And for my both money and based on my understanding of Trump so far, I think he chose that extreme option because he was especially irritated or taunted by that tweet that the Supreme Leader had made just the day before.
Time will tell what Soleimani's death and the new economic sanctions mean for the Middle East. But as we contemplate what the future holds for the U.S. and Iran, we also want to assess how we got here. This tense relationship stretches way beyond just the events of this past week. So what can the U.S. and Iran's history teach us about the current situation? I asked Hossein to take us all the way back to 1953, when the U.S. helped orchestrate a coup to overthrow Iran's prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh.
Mossadegh had decided to push for the nationalization of Iran's oil against the British, who controlled Iran's oil resources. And in that push, the Brits were not getting anywhere, and it was very clear that Iran had every possible right to renegotiate the deal. This, you have to understand, was in the context of the rise of decolonization movements throughout the so-called Third World, and Mossadegh was seen as a kind of a folk hero of many of those Third World movements. Initially, he had a friend in President Truman in the United States, because the United States very much favored that self-determination drive by many of these countries, and the Truman administration had rebuffed requests by the British government and British intelligence to co-sponsor a coup and overthrow Mossadegh. And so the British didn't get far with Truman, and Truman, in fact, invited Mossadegh to come to the United States, where Mossadegh addressed a joint session of Congress and made his country's case along the lines of the Declaration of Independence and the American Constitution. But the British kept pushing for this. And here there's a very interesting historical tidbit that is oftentimes overlooked. The lead American barristers or lawyers for the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company in this period were John Foster Dulles and Alan Welsh Dulles. The Dulles brothers would go on to become powerful figures in the Eisenhower administration. They had been lawyers for Anglo-Iranian Oil Company when Mossadegh was pushing for the nationalization drive, and they were in fact one of the lobbyists for that oil company in Washington trying to get the Truman administration to sponsor this operation against Mossadegh. They didn't get far until Eisenhower comes into office, and Eisenhower initially rebuffed their requests as well, and in a very provocative episode, they finally resorted to basically pushing the president to drink a great deal of whiskey and consume a great deal of alcohol in the Oval Office, and at the 11th hour, signing off on the operation that would approve of the coup against Mossadegh. So the United States co-sponsors this coup with the British Secret Intelligence Agency, MI6, and Mossadegh is overthrown through the supply of some funds and some organization underground by royalist forces in 1953. And Mohammad Reza Shah, the son of the exiled Reza Shah, comes back and becomes the autocratic royal head of state in Iran thereafter.
And is there any blowback to that in Iran itself?
Not immediately, although the episode was so rancid domestically that the legitimacy of the Shah from the get-go was very much undermined. Mm-hmm. So the initial blowback was that Iran's fractious politics really was driven largely on account of foreign interference, and especially American and British nefarious designs on Iran's sovereignty. And that memory really got bottled up and became a key driver of the slow, steady, but eventual rise of political Islam, not just in Iran, but throughout much of the Middle East. And that legacy obviously culminates in the 1979 revolution.
Well, tell me a little bit about that 1979 revolution.
Yeah, in 1979, you had a multi-pronged, pluralistic revolutionary movement of leftists, of nationalists, of secularists, Islamists, as well as fanatical Islamists, who had all united in the cause of overthrowing the Shah through a popular revolt. The Shah saw this coming and departed Iran on account of a health check with his doctors in the West and never returned. And of course, it was discovered soon after that he had cancer and was dying anyway. But in the period that he vacated and left, Khomeini returned from exile from the suburbs of Paris, of all places. Ayatollah Khomeini had become the de facto leader, spiritual leader of this revolution, and had been thought by many of these participants that he would remain in that role throughout. But once he was put in exile by the Shah, first he was exiled to Iraq, where Saddam immediately exiled him out because he had a big Shia population and didn't want antipathies against him being fed by Khomeini's presence there as well. So he shipped him off to Paris, and the French took him in, and he was in the suburbs of Paris recording tapes And so when Shah left the country on this holiday, Khomeini returned triumphantly and immediately declared that he would be seeking to establish an Islamic republic.
Now, I know that the United States supported the Shah to the end, but what was their attitude towards Khomeini initially?
It's remarkable. They knew very little about him. One of my favorite CIA declassified documents that we got our hands on is this kind of frantic back and forth memoranda that are going inside the Carter administration's national security circles. And at one point, one of the key principals blatantly writes in a memo, "What is an Ayatollah?" Let alone, "Who is Ayatollah Khomeini?" It's a story of massive intelligence failure because Khomeini had been seen as this kind of very parochial player, someone whom Westerners really didn't understand. The clerics, you have to understand, had always been on the margins of Iranian politics. The British understood the significance of clerical leadership in Iran much better, but they seemed to not have communicated that well to their American counterparts either. So it really caught them off by surprise.
The Iranian hostage crisis, which also occurred in 1979, what triggered it and what were the dynamics behind it?
You know, that episode is still a bit murky in terms of what exactly triggered it. Initially, Iranian students who were part of this radicalized faction that supported Khomeini had been staging a sit-in outside the U.S. embassy in protest of the Carter administration's decision to allow the Shah for a medical visit into the United States. And once that happened and the news reached these students who were sitting out there, some of the more radical ones started literally scaling the walls of the U.S. embassy. And from there on, events kind of took over, and the civilian government, the provisional government of Mehdi Bazargan, who were kind of mix of secular nationalists, but really modernist Muslims who were really wary of Khomeini, started to really go and try to talk down Khomeini, get him to issue a statement asking the students to back down. Khomeini immediately saw an opportunity in this to isolate this provisional government and really embolden his role more. So he, in fact, supported the students' move, and that was seen as a green light by them to go ahead actually and break through the doors of the embassy and take the hostages.
And that hostage crisis lasted for over a year. Was this instrumental in hardening American attitudes towards Iran? I would expect it would be.
Yes, I think that's the singular most potent event in shaping the narrative of U.S.-Iran relations, in America especially. The hostage crisis, I think, for the first time, you have to understand also, this was the first major televised antagonism that the United States had encountered. The television show Nightline was literally launched the day the hostage crisis began and had a countdown every night. And the crisis obviously went for 444 days. And each night there would be updates, and the image of kind of these fanatical students chanting "Death to America" and Khomeini's stern figure and profile being shown as this kind of menacing Ayatollah. That image has very much, I think, shaped a generation of American policymakers in their outlook toward Iran, let alone the general American public.
Well, the 1980s were dominated by the war between Iran and Iraq, an incredibly bloody and long war. The United States took Iraq's side in that war. Why is that?
This is a complex story because although the United States initially took the side of Iraq, its official policy would evolve to become the support of a war of attrition between Iran and Iraq so that both of them would be left weakened at the end of this ordeal. But initially, the United States took the side of Iraq because Iraq's invasion of Iran took place smack in the middle of the hostage crisis. Saddam invaded Iran from its southeastern borders on September 22nd, 1980. But in subsequent interviews that I personally have done and the oral history project that we co-convened in 2007, we've come to understand that the United States not only knew about this invasion ahead of time, but in fact greenlighted Saddam's advancements into Iranian territory and even shared intelligence with the Iraqi military at this point. And the reason they did this was because they wanted to pressure Khomeini into submission by first releasing the hostages. But the larger rationale that was driving this was that the United States was absolutely certain that Khomeini would fall, that Khomeini's vision of Islamic Republic had no legs whatsoever inside Iran. They thought that at best, he would last half as long as Mossadegh did as prime minister. And they saw this as something that was really alien to Iranian society, so they're not going to tolerate it.
Well, you wrote a book called Becoming Enemies, so I got to ask you how you explain the Iran-Contra affair where the United States actually sold arms to Iran.
Yes, it's the Reagan administration's relationship with Khomeini's Iran is fascinating because right off the bat, it starts in a transactional way. The Iranians, if you remember, held on to the hostages until the eve of Reagan's inauguration. And that was not an accident. They wanted to really deliver the message that they were the reason why Jimmy Carter was humiliated and was driven out of office. This was something that Republican operatives and President Reagan himself kind of tacitly approved of and appreciated. They saw them as really these kind of cunning transactional actors, that they were not so irrational afterwards. So the Iran-Iraq war starts to take off. Iran immediately starts to expand its military role outside the bounds of its own territory by funding radical Shia groups in Iraq and in southern Lebanon. Khomeini was a kind of a transnational Islamist who believed that the cause of exporting the Iranian revolution was actually very important to the survival of the Islamic Republic itself. So the way to safeguard this newfound country was to actually make sure that similar-minded Islamists throughout the region were nourished by the grace of this revolution. So the founding of Hezbollah was really important in this whole scenario. And Hezbollah obviously immediately set about attacking Western targets, but in the Lebanese Civil War, also really perfected the habit of hostage taking. And around 1982, the first waves of these hostage takings took place, and eventually more and more hostages were routinely taken and released. And the hostage taking of American personnel in southern Lebanon was what triggered this arms for hostages deal, as it was called. But basically, the deal was that the United States would sell arms to Iran and use that money to fund anti-Sandinista Contras in Nicaragua, which was against a law passed by Congress. And on top of all this, to use Israelis as the middlemen between Iran and the United States. So you have this kind of remarkable episode where the Israelis, they're literally the contact people between the Iranian government and the United States. And Hezbollah obviously is holding on to the hostages, and the Iranians are the party that immediately convinces them to release the hostages.
In the wake of 9/11, President Bush referred to the Iranians as the axis of evil, along with Iraq and North Korea. How was that message received in Iran?
With a great deal of shock and dismay, especially since it arrived at a time when Iran had been softening its outlook toward the West. If you recall, in 1996, a reformist movement had emerged inside of Iran, headed by Mohammad Khatami, who got elected in a landmark election in 1997 on a platform of reforming the Islamic Republic. And then 9/11 happens, and the Bush administration basically decides to paint the entirety of the Middle East, of really Muslim majority countries in the world, with a broad brush by introducing binaries such as, you know, you're either with us or against us. And Iran found itself in this very difficult position. Now, initially, Khatami signaled to the Americans that Iran would do everything that it can in the campaign to get rid of the Taliban in Afghanistan, which had not been friendly to Iran. Iran, in fact, 6 months prior to 9/11, almost went to war against the Taliban. So, you know, these ironies were kind of constantly pointed out by Iranians and reformists and say, look, you know, we are naturally more aligned with you than the Taliban are or Saddam is, but you need to listen to us. But then the Bush administration basically decided to go on this ideological crusade of ridding the world of what it thought to be terrorist regimes. And it decided that Iraq, Iran, and North Korea were going to be its kind of the centerpiece of its project. And Khatami was put in a difficult position domestically because the hardliners were empowered as a result of this rhetoric and started to kind of go at him by saying, you know, all these concessions that you've made to the Westerners, all this kind of groveling you've done at the feet of liberal democracy and reforms, et cetera, this is what you're getting in return for it. They don't care about democracy in Iran. All they want is to project American power, and now they're going to exploit this moment.
So to what extent did that kind of binary view of the world contribute to the Iranian nuclearization program and the situation we're in as we speak? Trump pulled out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iranian nuclear deal, and Iran has said they're going to begin processing of uranium again.
Well, it's fascinating. You know, Iran's first nuclear sites were built by Western engineers. Iran was part of Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace program initiative. And so those facilities that had been kind of dormant in Iran for many years had remained so pretty much all the way up to, you know, the first year after the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And by the time the invasion of Iraq take place, there's a very fascinating document. In 2003, a letter was sent to the Swiss embassy in Tehran by the Iranian government. So the letter to the Swiss ambassador was that Iran was willing to negotiate not only its role in the region in terms of funding radical Islamist groups in Lebanon and in the Palestinian territories, which had been the subject of dispute between Iran and Israel and the United States, but that in fact it would also be open to shutting down its nuclear facilities for good. That letter and the list of kind of concessions by Iran on it were sent to the Swiss ambassador on the eve of the Iraq war because the Iranians had thought that this would be, you know, a cakewalk for the American military, just like the American military thought, and that Iran would be next. At that point, the Bush administration was so triumphant in its rhetoric of regime change that it just dismissed the letter altogether. And Iran sort of went back and just waited in dread. But then dread turned into amazement as America couldn't control the fallout of the invasion, the looting that took place first, and then the vast incompetence of the American military to be able to even secure basic ministries, let alone provinces. And so Iran's nuclear activities start to ramp up just around the time that the insurgency in Iraq is spiking. Things are, going out of control. And Iranians were really just as amazed as anyone else just how badly that war was managed by the Bush administration, and took advantage of it by going full throttle, both in terms of their conventional activities in the region and their asymmetric and nuclear projects.
Well, you know, your reward for providing such a fascinating history is we're back to questions about the future, which historians are definitely not paid the big bucks to answer. But I do want to get your sense of where Iran is going with their nuclear program.
My thinking about Iran's nuclear program has always been that it is ultimately meant to be a bargaining chip between Iran and Western nations in the absence of direct diplomatic relations, especially with the United States. And we saw that basically be the case during the Obama years. Iran had really inched itself toward the amount, the percentage needed for weapons-grade uranium, but it had stopped just short of that because it now had the leverage to negotiate with the Obama administration on a whole range of issues regarding its program. And it succeeded in kind of reaching a kind of a nuclear deal that both recognized Iran's rights for the first time, like any other signatory to the non-proliferation treaty, to enrich uranium, which was a big win for the Iranians. They just wanted the recognition that they were a normal country entitled to enriching uranium under specified limits as long as their facilities were monitored, et cetera. The Obama administration granted that privilege to them. So Iran managed to get that. But then as a result of this kind of rising influence in the region after the Iraq War, it now had kind of once again reinstated its position as a major regional player. So it could always now oscillate between its conventional capabilities and a threat of a kind of a WMD program. And I think that's where Iran would like to stay going into the future, that it is a country that has, you know, nuclear power and it is operating within the limits set by international standards in that regard. But it also it has conventional capabilities that if they are threatened enough, it could kind of rely and fall back on its nuclear capabilities to negotiate its way out again.
So you are engaged in an oral history right now, and as I understand it, the project is examining how Iranians and Americans feel about the relationship between the two countries. Can you tell me a little bit about this and how you're even going about determining that?
Sure. So the Critical Oral History Workshop started in 2007. And it was modeled after a similar project that looked at U.S.-Soviet relations at the height of the Cold War. And that project was fundamentally about bringing policymakers from both countries together in a neutral setting, in a face-to-face exchange, to explore missed opportunities or the possibilities of a greater understanding moving forward. And so we applied that model to U.S.-Iran relations starting in 2007 by bringing former policymakers from Iran and the United States to really examine decision-making first and foremost. Why did they make the decisions that they did? What their perceptions were of the other side and how they viewed particular flashpoints as either opportunities or missed opportunities.
What surprised you the most? I mean, after a hard day's work of interviewing people and listening, when you were having a beer with a friend, finish the sentence, I can't believe.
The lack of empathy on the part of the greatest superpower this world has ever seen for much, much weaker adversaries in the world. I think the biggest takeaway for me has always been how difficult it seems to be for officials in Washington to put themselves in the place of others and to see the world through their eyes. And although that has proven to be the saving grace at really during ominous flashpoints in the second half of the 20th century, you look at the Cuba Missile Crisis, for instance, the lesson of just how important empathy is when it comes to foreign policy decision making seems to be lost when power disparities are at their greatest.
Hossein Banai is a professor at Indiana University's Hamilton Lugar School of Global and International Studies. He is the author of Becoming Enemies, U.S.-Iran Relations, and the Iran-Iraq War, 1979 through 1988. That's going to do it for us today, but you can keep the conversation going online. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.